Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, October the 8th. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check out the show all the time at our partners, MetsMemorizedOnline.com. Send me a tweet at Mike Silva Media, and you can get the show on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. There's one that I'm not on that you'd like to conveniently be on. Let me know. I'll try to get on it. Want to make this as easy a transaction as possible for you. Hope everybody's doing well. You probably weren't sure when I'd be popping back on because after last week's program with Dave Lennon about the pretty much putting a cap on the Mets 2017 season, talking about Terry Collins, really getting a feel for the postmortem, I think, on Collins. And we're done with that. I mean, Dan Worthen is gone. Terry Collins is gone. The only member of the staff, and if I could not have asked for a better scenario, is to keep Kevin Long and purge the rest. I mean, Pat Rosler, the assistant hitting coach, is sticking around, and that's fine. I mean, I always feel the pitching coach is more of a integral part, but maybe that's changing. Maybe I'm wrong, and that's something maybe that we need to examine more as the offseason goes on and learn a little bit more about. But anyway, you could not have asked for a better scenario as the Mets try to move forward. Now, enough with looking back of the, you know, when it comes to Terry Collins and what have you. I know Andy Martino at SNY over at Mets Blog wrote a piece about his rationale, and he shared a couple of, I guess, breakfast meetings he had with Collins over the last 6 or 7 years to give an idea of why he enjoyed covering Collins and why he enjoyed Collins so much. And it really just tied into what you heard last week from Dave Lennon, where they liked him. And, you know, that's a great segue into the next manager, because I really believe, and if you've been watching any of these postseason games, the bullpen part of the X's and O's is what a manager has to get their head wrapped around. And if you have a bad bullpen, there's not a lot you can do. You're still going to have issues. But I really believe, put together a bullpen with the components, the situational guys, your setup guy, your reliever, you may not have the best bullpen. I really believe that you can maximize those guys if you put them in the right position to be successful. Now, it's pretty absurd that you're getting 2 or 3 inning starts from the starters here in the postseason. But if you look back and you remember in 2006 when the Mets were in the playoffs and they had starting pitching issues, this is pretty much what you see what the Yankees are trying to do, and Cleveland, who has a very good starting staff, but had issues with Kluber in game two. What they tried to do is you try to get as much as you can from your starters. The minute you feel that the expiration has come on your starter, you go to the bullpen. And then you do matchups, try to get to your setup, your seventh inning guy, your eighth inning guy, your closer. And now that even has become where those guys can go multiple innings, which is just essential, I think, going forward. The days where a guy could just do one inning, sit down, I don't know if that could happen. Certainly not in the postseason. But the point is, the next Mets manager, who I believe will have a better bullpen. And I don't think the Mets have had bullpens that are great. That's been a huge issue with the way Alderson has built bullpens. But at times, I think because of the way they've been used and abused, and that was something talked about in that anonymous column, the anonymous quotes column that Mark Keurig had wrote a couple of weeks ago, or actually about a week ago in Newsday, that Collins would use and abuse players, and I think that's part of it. Now it's full throttle. You're in the playoffs now. You got to go out. You got to get it done. So anyway, that has become anybody that they interview, they have to get a feel. What is your bullpen philosophy? How are you going to manage this bullpen? If they can't do it, nothing else matters. Yes, handling the players, holding them accountable, changing what I think is a bit of a stale culture. And it seems like with the news of the purge at Las Vegas and the new hires down in AAA, that there was issues in AAA. It seems like the Mets had a lot of issues culture-wise throughout the organization, and I'm not sure that certainly falls on their Alderson. And that's the hit on Alderson, is why do you have these issues? Are they hiring the right people? But that's another conversation. The point here is you need to have a manager that culturally can make sure he holds these players accountable and manages that clubhouse. You don't want to have dysfunction. It can derail a season. And then managing the media, and unfortunately, and you saw it in the Andy Martino column over at Mets Blog, and if you haven't read it yet, go to Twitter at Mike Silva Media. I tweeted it out yesterday. They want to like the guy they're covering. They want the guy to be quotable. And a lot of the managers that are coming in, especially the fact if they were a modern ball player, someone who was in the 90s or late 90s into the turn of the century, it became an era where they were much more careful about what they say. And now with social media and all the things that go on with TMZ and everything, everybody's so concerned because everything could be blown out of proportion. Look at Aroldis Chapman liking something on Instagram about a negative comment about Joe Girardi. That's not getting a lot of play, but that's certainly something that that's coming up. So those are the things. Now, what are we doing here today? I have with us in just a little bit Jim Margalis, SouthsideSox.com. Why am I bringing Jim on? Well, Robin Ventura and Joe McEwing, two former Mets who hold a very special place in the heart of Mets fans because of their contributions to a pennant-winning team. Super Joe was a backup that made the most of his talent and was known to be a Randy Johnson slayer. Ventura was a Gold Glove third baseman, had an MVP caliber year in 1999. Might have had a better year than Mike Piazza. Might have been a more important component to the offense than Piazza that season. And in 2000, although he started to have some injuries and decline a little bit, was a big part of the 2000 pennant-winning team. Also went across town for the Yankees and was a very good component player for them in 2002 when he went over there after the Mets traded him that offseason. So a New York guy, a guy that everybody knows and loves, some concerns, and I think Margalis is going to talk a little bit about that. Jim, a blog called SouthsideSox.com over at SB Nation, although he's not covering Ventura night in and night out in the clubhouse, I wanted to get the feel of someone who is trying to write professionally, but also has the passion or channels the fans. So what was the feel? What was Ventura as a White Sox manager? He was there 4 years. There was some clubhouse disharmony and things of that nature. So how was he X's and O's wise? How did he manage a bullpen? What can Mets fans expect? Because if he's an early favorite, he could be an early favorite because Fred Wilpon likes him, and Fred Wilpon remembers him, or Jeff Wilpon remembers him as third baseman for the Mets in 1999 to 2000, 2001. But that's not what is going to make him a successful manager. So that's really, really, really important. So we'll get a feel from Margalis in just a couple of minutes as he's going to come join me here. It's actually Sunday morning I'm recording this. So if you're listening to this, and you're listening to this, you know, this is an early morning, I guess, edition of the podcast. The other thing you're hearing is the endorsements. Bobby Valentine making a huge endorsement for McEwing and Ventura. You got to take that seriously. I mean, Bobby V was probably right there with Davey Johnson, maybe even better than Davey Johnson, as perhaps one of the best managers, if not the best manager in Mets history. That's debatable, of course. You hear from Tony La Russa, who I respect immensely, about Chip Hale now, about how Chip may not have gotten the best deal in Arizona. I know that he gets fired, and now Arizona's got a 93-win team, and they're in the playoffs at a huge 24-game turnaround. I don't know, again, what's going on there. I don't follow the D-backs. I know there was issues last year, but it seems like with a similar type of club, I know J.D. Martinez is a big part of that. That was a midseason deal, but they were playing well before that. With a similar type of club, they're in the playoffs, so maybe they pulled the plug on Hale a little too quick. I don't know. That's why you have an interview process. And Chip Hale is certainly someone that you have to take seriously because he came in, by most reports, second place to Terry Collins back in 2010. So you have that name out there. And there's going to be tons of names. And I think what's most important is that everybody, the media, everybody keeps, oh, Alex Cora. Fine, bring in Alex Cora for interview. I'm fine. I'm not anti-Alex Cora. What I don't want is the narrative to drive the process. And the danger here is that you have an owner. And again, go back to the article by Mark Carrig. You have an owner that is influenced by this stuff. You have an owner that it has been put out there in the media. This is not a Mike Silva opinion. It has been put out there in the media that needs to have a manager that he could talk baseball with. Remember, the Mets are not a corporate entity. They're a family-owned business. Not like the Dodgers. You know, even with Derek Jeter and the Marlins, these are venture capital dollars being put in. And it's a different management ownership hierarchy. There's different things at play. Fred Wilpon is one of the few old-school, what I mean, owners that came in when the owner and the front office and the players, it was a closer connection. It wasn't this money conglomerate. And he wants to be like a family business, very, very accessible to the employees. It's not somebody who's going to be remotely managing or owning this team. And the manager is a big part of that. And he having a connection and an ability to trust and feel good about the manager is important. And you could complain about that. And is that something that in a vacuum should be the number one or even a priority? No, but he's signing the checks and he's paying the bills. Now, does that mean you hire somebody that is the wrong guy just to appease Fred? No, that has happened. I mean, I think Art Howe is a perfect example of that. So maybe there's a way that Sandy Alderson can split the baby in half here, for lack of a better word, and really appease Fred. You know, maybe Jeff Wilpon now could have a little bit more say on this and get the right guy. What I don't want is everybody to greenlight Alex Cora because the media all of a sudden has, for whatever reason, not knowing much about him, they covered him, and maybe he, you know, sure he's a smart guy, and he's getting a lot of pub, and I understand that having a connection or someone that can manage the Latino contingent of the Mets is important, but you need someone who can manage the entire roster. You need someone who really gets it, and I've been saying it, and I'll continue to say it, the things that I feel are most important for a managerial candidate. I think this is going to be a wide search. I think that they should do a wide search. I think they should really consider and turn over every rock. And I'll leave you with one thing before we get to Jim Margalis. I'll leave you with one thing. If, and we heard about it, and it's been now almost 48 hours since the Yankees lost Game 2, and yes, Joe Girardi made a huge blunder by not reviewing the strike 3 and then the subsequent grand slam, which really came to bite him. The Yankees weren't going to win this series anyway. Of course, winning Game 2 would have made this far more interesting. It would have given the Indians their first gut check going into Yankee Stadium for Game 3 in a five-game series, which is such a pivotal game if you're tied 1-1. If Joe Girardi is not retained because of this or any other reason, I don't know what Joe's future holds. I don't know if he wants to take time off. I don't know what he himself wants. And we won't know. But I will say this. I have a feeling that Joe wants to continue to manage. I have a feeling the Yankees will bring him back. And that's not fact. That's just opinion. But if he's okay with jumping in from the frying pan into the fire, if Joe Girardi is available in the next couple of days, I mean, he may be available as early as tonight. Now, I think the Yankees are going to lose. Maybe they win game three, but the Yankees are not going to go back to Cleveland. I think the Indians will take care of this, and I think Tanaka will get hit hard, and I think the Yankees will be swept, and away you go into the offseason here in New York for New York baseball. You have to, as the Mets, reach out and see what's going on and take them seriously. And here's a perfect example. I have been, and I'm not going to be a phony, I have been a Girardi critic. I thought they should have fired him pretty much very early into his tenure. He had issues. He had issues managing the clubhouse and really getting a feel. And I think a lot of that, if I remember, I'm trying to think back, was the intensity of Girardi and communicating with his players. And there was so much pressure. I mean, that was a Yankees team after Joe Torre that you're having a different level of intensity coming in. So there's always that change from one to the other in terms of different types of personalities. And that's a tough, from a culture standpoint, for the players sometimes to wrap their heads around. But since his issues, and I know the media doesn't like him because sometimes he lies. You saw that on Friday. I think he doesn't handle the initial reaction with the media well. He's not very quotable. He can be terse and grumpy. That's, you know what? To me, I don't care about that. The media is going to have to do their job. They're going to have to work a little harder. And they can't be running managers out of town because their job is made harder. That's not good reporting. And that's what this beat, unfortunately, has become. I think that Joe, even though those are accurate descriptors of his personality, anybody who's been in this town has watched the postgame of Joe Girardi knows that. Because he was with the Yankees, because he's had success, I think if he came across town, they would at least give him some leeway on that, although it wouldn't make them all that comfortable coming from Grandpa Terry to Joe Girardi. You could say all you want about Girardi, who's gotten hammered in the last 48 hours, rightfully so. But if this was Terry Collins, I don't know if they would have been hammered as much. And this goes to show you guys, continue to listen to me on this. This is so important. You have to look back and you have to really review what is being written and why it's being written and the agenda behind everything. Not everything is factual. There's a ton of agendas there. This is why the manager being liked sometimes is important. And if you're a manager and you can get the media on your side, that's going to be a great asset. I don't know if Joe Girardi cares, but look at Girardi's resume. All the faults, the bullpen management, the rigidness, maybe sometimes the goofiness that comes with Girardi, the success he's had, I understand the payroll. He's got a World Series title under his belt. He's got multiple playoff appearances under his belt. And he's seen the Yankees in what you would call a pseudo-rebuild. And he's had success. And even in those years, those Yankee teams were kind of on the peripheral where you knew they weren't good enough. They probably weren't going to make the playoffs. But it wasn't like it was a disaster. Terry Collins never did that. And some of those Yankee teams weren't great. Now, maybe the Mets didn't have as good of roster, 1 to 25, and certainly they didn't invest in the payroll like the Yankees did, but that's what you want to see out of a manager, maximizing what they have on the roster. Terry Collins never did that. We're not going to get into that. We've talked about that enough. So, anyway, that's my thought. Wide managerial search. I think tonight, if the Yankees lose, or if the Yankees lose and they will lose, at any point in the next couple of days, you want to add Girardi to that mix if the Yankees decide that they just can't get past what happened on Friday night. Let's take a quick break. When I return, Jim Margalis, SouthsideSox.com. He's a writer over there, has been blogging about the White Sox for well over a decade. Who are Robin Ventura and Joe McEwing? Are these guys that the Mets fans should put at the top of their list of desires for the next Mets manager? Let's learn a little bit about them as managers. We know them as players right after this. We're back, and joining me, yeah, we talk Mets here, and we like to talk about what's going on in the National League, the National League East, but the season's over, and a couple of former Mets have been rumored to be front runners for the open managerial position now that Terry Collins is no more, and did a little Google research, and it's hard to always look at what a manager is all about, but Jim Margalis over at Southside Sox SB Nation blog has covered the White Sox for over a decade. And when I Googled Robin Ventura, his name came up quite a bit. And get a chance to talk a little bit about Ventura, McEwing, his thoughts on their tenure over at the White Sox, and maybe what he thinks about them potentially coming over and managing the Mets. Jim, appreciate you coming on here on the weekend. First off, good morning here, and how are you?
Good morning, and I'm great. I'm a little surprised, to be honest, that I would be talking about Robin Ventura's future managerial positions or possibilities this early, or I guess this recent, since he was let go from the White Sox.
Yeah, and look, I'm with you. You know, I've read quite a bit of the stuff that you've put out there about Ventura. And it sounds a lot of the complaints that you have are the complaints I had about Terry Collins in a lot of ways. And I agree with you. Look, Robin Ventura is, used the term Hall, a very good third baseman. 100% agree. I loved Robin Ventura. And I think he was a big part of the Mets clearly going to World Series, veteran leadership, gold glove third baseman, great left-handed back, great personality. And I haven't watched enough White Sox to even comment on him as a manager. They're not even on the radar here in New York, and that's not meant to be disrespectful. It's just they're not.
Certainly.
So
yeah.
looking at this from afar, I see a guy who's a little bit low energy. I'm not saying that that's necessarily always a bad thing. Can't manage a bullpen. Seems to have done okay with the media out there in Chicago. Very nondescript, and it makes me wonder, to your point, which you just said, what's this all about, you know?
Well, it's I guess to understand Ventura's tenure is to kind of understand who he replaced. He replaced Ozzie Guillen, and the very end of the Ozzie Guillen tenure with the White Sox was very dramatic and volatile, and there was infighting between the manager and general manager and Jerry Reinsdorf, the owner, chairman. He operates from he's very loyal. And he's very loyal to both Guillen and Kenny Williams, the GM at the time. So, he didn't want to fire any of them. And basically, it got to the point where Ozzie said, either fire Kenny or I'm out of here. And so he arranged an exit to, Kenny stayed. Ozzie arranged an exit to Miami. And so the White Sox were looking for somebody who was, as happens so often in managerial changes, the opposite of Guillen. And Ventura was that in terms of both his demeanor and also his experience. They basically hired him off the couch. They brought him back briefly in the organization for a few months at the end of the 2012 season or the 2011 season, to be a special assistant and learn the farm system a bit and be involved in that level. And then all of a sudden he was out of complete surprise. He was on nobody's board. He basically was hired before the White Sox even started the process. Like, everybody was anticipating, okay, we're going to, put together a list and see the possibilities and get an idea of who's going to be interviewed. And all of a sudden, Ventura was the guy. And basically, the first year or so of Ventura's stay was very refreshing because Ozzie had really slacked off at the end. It became more about his competition with Kenny Williams. His lineups went to crap. Adam Dunn and Alex Rios had historically bad seasons. He played them every day. There was spite in his managing, and so to go from Ozzie to Ventura was to go to somebody who actually wanted to kind of see the White Sox win, or at least had that as the priority over, sending messages upstairs. And so, Adam Dunn was playing poorly, he got benched. He wasn't managing based on salaries and such, and that worked out pretty well. And then September came around, the White Sox were contending; they're actually in first place for most of the season. And his inexperience showed in that the September roster has expanded, and all of a sudden, I think he lost a sense of who was supposed to be on the roster in the first place, because he is pitching all these AAA guys or pinch hitting, defensive replacements, et cetera, putting all these AAA guys in really awful positions, like high leverage positions and they lost lead and so forth. And so from there, he thought, okay, decent season, obviously a learning experience. And then you'd think that, he'd improve and for some reason just kind of stagnated there. He never really showed, the second stage in his development that he'd want to see from the manager. And because the White Sox are loyal, they didn't fire him for another 4 years, and that's four straight losing seasons.
Interesting. And I'm curious your thoughts, because I really thought to myself, how do you describe, because people always say to me, well, who do you want to manage? And look, I'm not in the interviews. You're not in the interviews. We're not calling the shots. You look at this, And it's not just, and you made great points, pinch hitting, defensive replacements. To me, there are three things, and I want to get your thoughts because you sound like you kind of look at things a little bit deeper than just the surface. Number one, they got to manage the clubhouse. And the White Sox had a couple issues, well-documented issues. And that doesn't mean be their friend. It means accountability. It means kind of knowing your personnel, partnering in the right way with your stars. They got to manage the media. You could comment on that. Terry Collins did a great job. And part of managing the media, unfortunately, is they like you. And you make their jobs easier. And I understand that, but it bothers me sometimes. The third piece, even if you do the first two, if you can't manage a bullpen in today's game, and if anybody's watched the playoffs the last couple of nights, it's becoming a bigger thing. And it's not a boilerplate. It's not paint by numbers anymore. You really got to know what you're doing. If you can't manage a bullpen, then the other two don't matter, and you're not going to be successful. And to me, it sounds like Ventura may have done okay on the first two, and at least I've seen a lot of talk, at least from the major media outlets, that at times his bullpen management or even going too long with a starter were big issues.
Oh, yeah, to speak to your first point with the clubhouse, that was one of the reasons why Rick Hahn, who is now the GM, replacing Kenny Williams. Kenny Williams is now the president of, or vice president of baseball ops. Rick Hahn defended the decision to keep him by saying he was very good at keeping the clubhouse. You know, basically his, you know, he could be optimized from 7 to 10 p.m. But, you know, before and after games, you know, you couldn't question his abilities. And then the Adam LaRoche thing happens and the Chris Sale jersey slashing thing happens. And that might have been like a Chris Sale problem, but they'd butted heads before. And Ventura, to his credit, he always was the adult in the situation. He never tipped his hand. He never talked about private conversations or private discipline or anything like that. Sale tended to go to the media or be loud enough to be heard by the media through doors. And Ventura was not that guy. But, you know, I guess that last you know, characteristic or positive selling point of Ventura's tenure basically went by the wayside because these two flare-ups became national, and in LaRoche's case, is an international story about children in the workplace, which is really bizarre. I was not expecting that. You know, for the bullpen, he likes to ride his starters, and with the White Sox, they had a very good starting rotation. Sale and Quintana and Jeff Samardzija and, you know, John Danks when he was, you know, reliable. And so he could go to a starter three times through the order, maybe even into the fourth time through the order. But when those starters started to show some, you know, wear and tear, John Danks was kind of a shell of himself by the end. Samardzija was shaky, you know, as these guys wore down, and the White Sox needed to get every game, you know, because they're on the fringe of contention. It really showed how, I guess, loath he was to use his relievers. And then when he had an order in his bullpen towards the end, it was just using the same guys in the same order, no matter how well they were pitching and no matter, you know, I guess how, yeah, you know, more than hot and cold streaks, just how much they're struggling to get swings and misses and how much their stuff was lacking. And that was really a strange development because I think it was 2013, 2014, the White Sox really didn't have a set bullpen order, and Ventura showed some aptitude in responding to it and shaking his order around and operating okay without a set closer until one became evident. You know, he showed some flexibility and such, and so you're kind of, at least from my perspective, I was optimistic that he would develop into something kind of, I guess, sabermetrically friendly, in which he, you know, responds to leverage and not so much save situations. But that kind of went away, and by the end, it was really hard to, aside from somebody who was professional until the very end, and I think Ventura, you can say all you want about him, but he was a very, he was always the adult in the room, basically, no matter what happened. And he didn't lose any dignity or respect when it came to just his standing as a person. It was more just his acumen as manager, which just kind of didn't really show anything by the end. And the White Sox being how they are and being as loyal as they are, they basically made him fire himself. they said, like, well, he can come back if he wants. And I guess it had been settled for a month that Ventura wasn't coming back, but they just didn't have the stomach or the guts to fire him. And so he basically had to say, I'm not good enough for this, which I guess is, you know, like I said, being the adult in the room and taking responsibility when others wouldn't. But, yeah, it just didn't leave me thinking like there's a great manager here. And yeah, I don't want to, you know, give absolutes because we've seen them time and time again, guys learn from their first managing jobs, you know, and unsuccessful first forays in the position. So I don't want to say he won't be, but I just didn't see anything there.
And it's interesting. I mentioned the media. It sounds like he handled them well because when you really, and again, I'm doing Google searches here because I'm not out in Chicago, so you could comment on that. You're probably one of the biggest critics of Ventura that comes up when you bring up Rob Ventura. I mean, it sounds like he got along with the media, and although maybe they felt the job wasn't completely competent, that goes a long way. There's not a lot of criticism of him, despite, too, like you said, the LaRoche thing was interesting because, you know, it's a precedent-setting type of thing for other big league stars. And, you know, there's a lot there. I didn't realize how much there was there. And the White Sox, I guess the other part of that, they were, you know, people don't talk about them. They've lost 90-plus games quite a few times, but they're not bad. They don't have bad talent. Maybe they're short on a few things. It's not like this was a train wreck roster during his tenure.
Yeah, I think, you know, there are two things. One is that, you know, you won't see a lot of criticism about Ventura because, you know, I guess I look at games more on decision, yeah, especially when the White Sox are contending. I like to look at decisions and where games were, you know, the make or break decisions that go along the course of nine innings. So, you know, that's more of style of my writing. And so, you know, maybe newspapers won't pick up on that. And also I'm writing as a fan, or at least, you know, I try to channel fans and try to speak to them. And so, you know, one of the biggest criticisms about Ventura was that, you know, from the fan level, was that he really didn't show a lot of emotion, didn't really show a lot of responses. You know, if the White Sox made errors, he didn't chew anybody out. You didn't see him talking to anybody and addressing anybody in public. You know, the benchings were slow and such towards the end. And, you know, I think that can be carried overboard pretty easily, and that any kind of shouting manager is going to have a pretty short shelf life. But, you know, the running joke was that, you know, anytime Ventura had to explain something that went wrong, he would just say, it's one of those where, you know, it was just kind of this a little bit of passive voice explanation, and not really, you know, and that's where I get back to the point of like acumen or learning. It wasn't a sense that, you know, he was learning or taking these decisions or wrong turns personally. It was just more a matter of like, this happened and it went wrong and it's just one of those things. That was his catchphrase. And so that became a little bit frustrating after a while, seeing the same mistakes being made over and over again. It's like, it's not one of those things. It's many of those same things. So, you know, that's, I guess that's where, you know, my writing may differ when reading about it. But, yeah, it's, you know, he was always professional. And the White Sox, because the front office had a lot of swings and misses with free agents, you know, Samardzija was disappointing. He was a trade, but disappointing. LaRoche was a disaster. You know, and before him, Dunn and Rios were disasters. And at least initially, Rios kind of salvaged himself. Dunn never really came through. Jeff Kepinger really fell flat. Deanna Navarro was a disaster. Alex Avila didn't work out. Like, they had a bunch of these high-profile free agent swings and misses that really left them a studs and duds team. Stars and Scrubs, where you had, you know, Jose Abreu, Chris Sale, Adam Eaton, Jose Quintana doing the heavy lifting, but not really getting a whole lot of support. So, and based on the way that these players have come to the White Sox and had a hard time finding jobs afterwards, it was hard to blame Ventura for that part of the equation.
Yeah, and you know, the Mets have had that issue. They, the teams, especially when they're on a budget, they'll build rosters, 8-10, you know, superstars, and then the final 15 spots are the, you know, the dartboard, you know, the value equation. And I don't think you could do that anymore. I mean, again, if this playoffs is showing anything, the old paint-by-numbers bullpen, your 7-8-9 guy, which if you get three closers, I guess you could do that, that's becoming harder. You really need a manager that knows what they're doing. And I think it dispels, and I don't know if that's going on in Chicago because it happens here a lot with Alderson. Well, the front office is dictating the lineup. The front office is dictating a lot. And I said to myself, well, Terry Collins was just fired, and one of the issues was they didn't like how he was running things. I can't imagine, and I laugh all the time when people say that. I'm like, do you guys think, and maybe I'm wrong, I'm not in the dugout, there's a phone in the dugout, or this is Stratomatic where there's like a little app and they're just telling, you know, the manager, hey, you got to do this right now? Because I don't think that's what's going on, and if that's what people think is going to happen, then, you know, maybe then the front office should sit in the computer in the office, like in a remote area, like it's war, and just like, you know, hit a button and things happen. Like, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, and that's not mainstream all the time. That's also the blogosphere and the fans and things like that.
Yeah, and you know, with Rick Renteria taking over this year, you know, the White Sox were they were a rebuilding team. They lost you know, they won 67 games, so it's like they didn't have the same expectations that Ventura's club had. So it was hard to do an apples comparison between the two. But the two things that jumped out were, one, that Renteria seemed to show more whimsy with his lineups. Like, oh, let's give this a shot. You know, it wasn't maybe optimal from a run scoring standpoint. You know, might have a low OBP guy up top, or, you know, guys on a hot streak, you know, Paddock in seventh, but there's more kind of let's see what happens, more you see the pants experimentation that you know, after Ventura being somewhat rigid with his roles, was kind of refreshing. And there's also the matter of energy in that, you know, there is a catchphrase Hawk Harrelson coined that Ricky's boys don't quit. And yeah, that kind of, it was very fun to watch. Like for a rebuilding season, there are a lot of games that are more interesting than they had a right to be. And I think it's credit to Ventura, but I also on the other side of the coin, you know, kind of wondered, well, they aren't quitting. Were Ventura's boys quitting? Were they, you know, is there an inverse to draw there? Maybe isn't zero sum like that, but you know, there was a kind of sense that everybody just stopped responding to him, and based on the differences between how guys are being deployed and such, I think it was really a, you know, managerial choice in how these players are being deployed, especially like you know, as Ozzie Guillen is precedent, that last 3 months that he was in Chicago and the White Sox were on the fringe of wild card contending. And, you know, Kenny Williams had to come out and say, like, stop playing Adam Dunn. Like, stop, you know, I understand I made a mistake here. This guy's a disaster. Stop, you don't have to use salaries to dictate, lineup spots and starts and such. Alejandro Diaza, you know, he was a better option at the time. Dion Vicieto was a better option at the time. Like, use these guys. And he didn't. He was basically, like, sticking his middle finger up to the front office and trying to force something to happen. So if the White Sox had that kind of power, they would have used it years ago in this case. So I think Ventura is just more, he's somebody who likes to kind of set it and forget it. And I think in some cases where you have a, you know, like say a Washington type situation or St. Louis type situation, where you have a lot of talent and you just need a steady hand, somebody who doesn't upset players or rock the boat too much. I think he might be a fine choice, but I think a lot of guys would be a fine choice for that case. If you need somebody to get extra wins out of a team, I don't think he's necessarily the best choice based on what he showed in Chicago.
And you just said Alejandro Diaz is a better lineup choice. Do you know how many Mets fans are banging their head against the wall here in that one? So that's a funny thing.
Oh, well, he was a fine player for the White Sox for a number of years, but yeah, he did have some problems on the base paths and such. So when he stopped producing, fans turned on him pretty quickly.
So you made earlier a great point about how they had the Ozzie Guillen, and then you go to a different personality. And also, baseball's a copycat sport. Every time, I remember, the ultimate copycat was back when the Florida Marlins, back then they were the Florida Marlins, won the World Series with Castillo and Juan Pierre at the top of the lineup. Everybody's like, well, you got to win now with speed, like it's the 1985 Cardinals again. So people try to copy that. And then it's like, well, you got to win with home runs, or you got to win with like a three closer. So everybody copycat. So the ultimate copycat is, and it usually has to do with the owner of the team. You get tired of one personality, so you go with the exact opposite. The Mets did that with Art Howe after Bobby Valentine. Now, I don't know if you could really articulate Joe McEwing. I've spoken to Joe McEwing many years ago when he was in, I believe, Double A. So I'd have to go back and really listen to that and get a feel of him. But he's you know, old school, they describe, which is a narrative, but it's got a little bit different energy than a Robin Ventura. Here's a guy that had a fight to be on a roster. Maybe he wasn't the most talented. He's definitely in demand. He's going to go on multiple managerial interviews. Do you have any take on that? Because in a lot of ways, that plays into it, personality. And I don't know exactly where the Mets are going to go with that, but McEwing, who may be the exact same thing as Ventura, but disseminate that information completely different, you know, that may come into play here. I'm curious your thoughts on McEwing because he's a bench coach or he's a base coach. It's harder to get a feel of him in that sense.
Yeah, it's, you know, he's survived the change from Robin Ventura to, you know, Rick Renteria. So I think the White Sox hold him in high esteem for what he does. And he's always been considered very diligent when it comes to, you know, I guess the spring training part and the, you know, pregame prep and scouting and you know, going over video and scouting reports and so forth. You know, he's hard worker and such. So yeah, I think that carries over from role to role, and he's played a few between bench coach and third base coach and such. He was one of those guys. He was in the White Sox organization, climbing the ladder as a coach, and he was one of those, you know, who were considered maybe a potential replacement for Ozzie Guillen, or you know, and he had jobs have been floated elsewhere, and all of a sudden Robin Ventura gets this job, and so. You know, he did join Ventura's staff, but it was like, well, why isn't McEwing a better choice? You know, he has experience. He's been doing this for a while. He's shown that he wants to. That was the other question with Ventura, was like, yeah, that dogged him throughout his career, is that when he was hired, they basically asked, did he even want to do this? the White Sox had to convince him to do it. And that kind of dogged him for the rest of his career because he didn't show a whole lot of energy and such. And at Sox Fest one year, the fan convention, a fan actually asked him, like, you know, do you have a pulse to his face? And Ventura did, like, and you could see Ventura's face change. And shut the fan down. And it was kind of like, I was happy to be in the room because I think you just kind of sensed the tension there. That was fascinating. I don't think you would have gotten that from video or, you know, audio or whatever, but, that was always the question with Ventura, and McEwing has always been the kind of the optimal traditional manager in waiting, where he's coached up the ladder. He's gotten rave reviews for all his work in the minor league system. You know, did all the work as a coach, and, you know, he is a bit old school, but he also has a hand in the White Sox shifting more and being more along the lines of, you know, kind of optimizing the defense for pull strategies and pitchers and such. The White Sox were a lot more active. And I think that kind of is reflected by the, you know, the manager in a sense, because Ventura, when he took over from Guillen, they shifted more, and then he became a bit more lax in that regard. Renteria took over, they started shifting more. So yeah, I don't think he has a whole hand in how much they shift, but he's had a big part in how they go about doing it and arranging the fielders as such. So he has some sabermetric cred there. I think if he took over, he'd be somebody who you'd consider traditional, but I think he deserves a chance to, you know, and I think a lot of guys are in the same boat where they deserve a chance to show what they can do, actually being the main voice in a dugout, because the players do respect him. You know, no players have ever had a problem with him. And he's also been, you know, coming up the lines in the ranks in the minor leagues, he's been somebody who does, you know, have a sense of, you know, order about a dugout and such. So he's not a pushover. So it'd be nice to see what he could do, because everybody's been saying for years that he would be a fine choice to be the main voice.
Interesting. And by the way, I got a couple more here, but Jim Margalis, Southside Sox, at Jim Margalis on Twitter, talking a little bit about Robin Ventura and what's been going on with the White Sox over the last few years, Joe McEwing. It's interesting, Jim, because you guys have a new manager and you talked a little bit about it, but it's not like, and I've been watching baseball since the mid-80s. I'm not that old, but it used to be when there was a big market, Chicago, New York, L.A., the first thing you would do, any sport, you'd look for the big name, Lou Piniella. In the NBA, it was always Phil Jackson or Pat Riley. That's not the case in baseball anymore. Like, it's a you could see the change. Like, who's the next great manager? Who's the next guy that's going to be looked at like Jim Leland or Tony La Russa? Is it Joe McEwing? Mm-hmm. Is it? I mean, remember, Tony La Russa got fired too. I don't, you know, I was not in Chicago. I don't know if you were too young or if you were around. You know, I guess the White Sox didn't think very much about La Russa back in the '80s, and he did okay.
That was Hawk Harrelson as GM. That was Hawk Harrelson's year as the general manager.
Yeah, right. That's true.
That showed why it was only 1 year.
And Hawk, I mean, I feel like you may love him over there, but it's hard on the other side. He can be hard to take. But I don't, you know, again, that's what I said earlier, what I look for in a manager. I mean, and I think the fact that you can't just say it's five games one way or the other, I think it's important because I think that they set the tone on the field. I think that the fans underrate it. Maybe it's a little overrated by the media. But we're in a unprecedented times. You know, who's going to be considered a good manager? I mean, Yankees fans this weekend want to fire Joe Girardi. I think he's okay. Now, he made a bad move the other night. But what do you think? I mean, it's interesting because it's so hard for me to say this is the guy I want because I don't know. If Lou Piniella 15 years ago was available, that's the guy I would want maybe. You know, so it's interesting. I'd like to get your take from an out-of-towner's point of view.
Well, I think with the White Sox, you know, they've – typically hired first-time managers. Ozzie Guillen was a first-time manager. Jerry Manuel was a first-time manager. You're familiar with him.
Oh,
Robin Ventura, first-time.
Oh, good God. now you really made everybody. First, Diaz, and now Jerry Manuel. Jerry Manuel had a good few weeks in the U.S. But,
and I think Jeff Torborg, too.
Not
a
strength. Not a
big
strength.
Jeff Torborg, too. You like your former White Sox managers. It's nuts. But I think with the White Sox, they tend to hire first-time guys because they have a very entrenched pitching system. Don Cooper has been the pitching coach for years, and he's been in the system for decades. It's a top-down approach. The White Sox kind of use Cooper to set the agenda for the minor leagues and for scouting and such. So he's entrenched, and I think when you look at hiring a veteran manager, at least for the White Sox side, they would want to hire their own pitching coach probably. Renteria was an exception. He managed 1 year with the Cubs, and then they brought him over as the bench coach for Ventura in his final year. And, you know, Renteria was, I guess maybe he, you know, because he was only there for 1 year with the Cubs and didn't really, it was in a rebuilding year there. He didn't really get a chance to have his own kind of success there. He didn't really have a say in who he could manage or, you know, who he wanted to, you know, hire and fire. But Cooper is very important, and that might be the case with more teams. Like you look at the Indians and their throwing program, for instance, although Francona is a very strong choice in his own right. But I think with veteran managers, they want to bring in their own guys, and I think teams might be more of an organizational approach where they have their hitting coach they want, they have their they have their offensive approach they want, they have their pitchers, they have their training staff, biomechanics, whatever. They have guys they want to look for, and so when they hire a manager, they want somebody who fits in with what they're kind of already doing, and maybe is the guy who sets the tone for the clubhouse and makes the helps turn the 25-man roster into a winning product, but maybe doesn't kind of set the, overarching agenda or program for, further down the line. That might be more of an organizational thing. So at least with the White Sox, that's how I see it happening, and that's how it's been. With the way Cooper has had success with pitchers, and this year is a bit of an exception, but they've been exceptionally healthy as pitchers, you can kind of see the point in the White Sox doing it the way they have.
All right, last question. I'm curious because here in New York, I mean, I don't really hate the Yankees like I used to when I was young. Do I want to see the Yankees celebrate? No. Do I get a kick out of them getting tweaked and having a terrible loss in the playoffs? Of course. But, okay, in Chicago, White Sox, Cubs, I don't know if it's quite the same, but you have the Cubs with the 100-year curse being broken, and now they're going for back-to-back. You got Chris Sale struggling in the playoffs, and it sounds like things didn't end well over there. I mean, as a White Sox fan, do you root against the Cubs? Is there Cubs hate? Do you hate the fact that if the Red Sox win and Chris Sale's the reason that, that's kind of like a dagger? Like, what is the White Sox perspective this postseason on those kind of things?
Well, I think that they've always been the little brother to the Cubs, like the Mets, the Yankees, and it's always been frustrating. And there's a big divide between classes and media coverage, and it's very much a little brother big brother relationship in all senses. And even when the White Sox had the drought, it's like they the Cubs were lovable losers, the White Sox are just losers. When they both the White Sox couldn't spin their failures into success, even a cult kind of success, the way the Cubs did. So I was just like, we couldn't understand why everybody loved them, because they were just as bad and not as interesting on the field. But they have Wrigley, they have Harry Carey. For instance, he started with the White Sox. He got his TV fame with the White Sox, then jumped over the Cubs and became this whole, national phenomenon with WGN and such. So it's just been, the White Sox have always been on the wrong end of every kind of business decision, every kind of city decision, that kind of thing. And so there's just decades of resentment. So, the hate runs deep there. I tend to be more, I get tired of them, but I have some friends who are decent Cubs fans. Like the Cubs fans I know are decent. Like I can have baseball conversations with them. So when the Cubs won, I was like, I'm happy for so-and-so, because I at least knew what they were going through personally, and I can relate to it on that level. But when it comes to the rest of the postseason, Chris Sale kind of, I think everybody saw that, it wasn't going to work out. And so they don't wish him poorly, but maybe they don't want him to win the Cy Young just because they want, their face to be rubbed into it. But I think, my stance with Sale is that I'd like to see him make the Hall of Fame. He's on that track. It's fun when former White Sox make the Hall of Fame, like Tim Raines. He was, not the player he was at the Expos and such, but he was played some key roles on good teams. Fun to see him go in. With Sale, he was fun to watch. He was appointment viewing. I root for him ultimately, even if I don't want him to have a seamless transition to the Red Sox. Maybe the White Sox, what they did wrong with them was so easy to fix, that'd be frustrating in that case. I think the Yankees right now are kind of a White Sox spinoff in a way, because they have Robertson, Canely, and Frazier. I'm familiar with those characters, so I'm kind of interested to see how they do. But ultimately, I think at the postseason, especially in the American League, if you have the Indians, Yankees, Astros, Red Sox, especially, in the way it's looking, Indians, Astros, that's a hell of an ALCS. And I really don't care who wins. I just want to go seven. So I think in that go ahead.
It's interesting. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, and I know you got to go, but Todd Frazier, an interesting name, local guy, free agent. Mets might need a third baseman. I'm not crazy about the metrics I see. I mean, he's had some good runs with Cincinnati. Hitters ballpark defensively. He does a lot of little things, it seems, well. What do you think of Todd Frazier? I mean, I know the contract would depend on it, but is he a little underrated because he's basically a 210 hitter the last couple of years?
He's adequate. Like, you wouldn't get too excited about him. Hits a lot of pop-ups and such, so a lot of his at-bats end in frustrating fashion, but he's got power, and he plays a good defensive third base. You know, he's a good veteran guy to have in the clubhouse, and that was one of the things with the LaRoche thing, is that, you know, he was perceived that either Frazier or Jimmy Rollins or such said, like, why is this kid in the clubhouse all the time? Why is he in our drills? So I think there was some professionalism there that the White Sox maybe were lacking and caused some friction, but I think he's a he's for a 1-year contract. I think I wouldn't want to go long term with him. But if you can do worse, and the White Sox have done worse, right. And so Frazier, even though he hit in the low 200s and popped up a ton, did hit 40 homers, played a good third base, and did solve that hole. And I think if you're looking at a complete abyss at third base, he's somebody who is a noted and noticeable improvement. But I think if you're looking for somebody to push a team over the top, he's not that guy.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. Another thing that just came to my mind that you brought up Chris Sale. There was also that controversy with Sale to the bullpen under Ventura, right? So
that
we didn't really talk about. That was another whole thing, you know?
Yeah, that was his first, like, health scare, I think. And Ventura being new to the thing, that was his first, like, my career is in this guy's hands. Or his career is in my hands, I should say. And so when he had some elbow issues and Sale being the way he throws and his build, everybody's afraid his elbow is going to explode. I guess he took that very seriously. He took that too seriously, and it required Sale going over the top and appealing directly to Kenny Williams and basically getting into a screaming match. And that's a common theme over the last several years of Sale, is that he had to solve a lot of problems through screaming. And then he restored. He went back to the rotation, and ultimately it's worked out in terms of multiple All-Star appearances, Cy Young finishes, et cetera. So I think that was a bit of an aberration just because it was Ventura's first time dealing with an injury and a significant one. But I think that showed the mistake the White Sox made in hiring somebody who just hadn't been in those decisions, like even at a bench coach level or a minor league level, where you're actually having to play guys through pain or, you decide to sit guys, et cetera. That's where his newness really showed off. That really didn't appear again, you know, that kind of injury dilemma / controversy. That was one thing that didn't end up repeating on him.
Well, listen, I didn't realize the kinship we could have. I mean, we could do an hour on Torborg and Jerry Manuel. I mean, the name brought up, Alejandro de Aza. I mean, the best name you brought up are McEwing and Ventura. And Ventura, I don't know if after talking to you and after reading about it, I don't know, as much as I love him as a third baseman, I don't know if he's the answer, of course. So anyway, you've been generous with your time. Thank you. Thank you so much. At SouthsideSox.com, at Jim Margalis on Twitter. Anything else you want to pop before I let you go on with your weekend?
Also at Southside Sox on Twitter, and we have a podcast too, the Southside Sox podcast, available where podcasts are available.
Yep. I'll come on and talk about Jerry Manuel with you if you ever want. So if you ever have dead air that you want to fill. good stuff. All right, man. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Good stuff, and appreciate it. Take care, my friend.
You too.
Jim Margalis, SouthsideSox.com, SB Nation blog. Interesting stuff. Let's take a quick break. I have some final thoughts. I want to talk a little bit about Jay Bruce real quick. I know I got into the managerial stuff in the front end before Jim came on. And I want to give you an idea about a free agent. If the Mets are going to just go after one free agent, I want to give you an idea of where my mind is at. And it's not Jay Bruce, because I think that's going to be, at least in the near term, because of what's been going on in the series with the Yankees, the popular name that Mets fans might want to have a reunited situation. I have a name that I've been looking at for a while, and there's a lot to that. So let's take a quick break, come back, final thoughts, talk a little bit about that, wrap up, and we'll be back right after this.
Hey, Mets fans, I'm going to let you in on a little secret. If you're looking for the best unbiased and independent coverage of the New York Mets, then look no further than MetsMerizedOnline.com. MetsMerized Online is the go-to place for comprehensive Mets coverage, including exclusive interviews, daily original articles, great weekly features, in-depth analysis, minor league reports, game-by-game breakdowns, and so much more. Find out why thousands of fans turn to MetsMerized Online every day to get the latest news and opinions about the Mets. Coming from an impressive staff of the most passionate fans and skilled writers ever assembled, all in one place. Check it out for yourselves, Mets fans. Go to MetsMerizedOnline.com right now. That's Mets, MERIZED, online.com, and get MetsMerized today.
Now the the pitch. Swung on, hit high, hit deep to left center. It is gone! Jay Bruce has come through again. He's tied the game at 8 with a solo blast to the bleachers in left center. And finally, the Indians get to David Robertson.
We're back as I wrap up today's show, and really good segment. I had a lot of fun there with Jim Margalis, and you don't get a chance to talk often on this podcast with bloggers from outside the bubble, outside the Mets bubble. So to get a feel of what he thinks a good manager is, what he thinks about Ventura and Ewing, and I forgot. I mean, all the kinship you really have with the White Sox, with the former managers of guys like Jerry Manuel and Jeff Torborg and things like that. So. Interesting segment. Appreciate with Jim taking some time out on a weekend to do that in his busy schedule. And he made a point that in the open I alluded to, but I didn't really even realize I was alluding to it. And it happens so often in sports in general, not just in baseball, but the manager, when a manager gets fired, the next guy having the exact opposite personality than that prior manager becomes a big theme. You saw it when Pat Riley left. When Pat Riley quit, they brought Don Nelson in the mix, and Don Nelson could not be the exact opposite of Pat Riley. And that was lauded early, very early, and for a very short time in his tenure. And they realized that wasn't what that Knicks team needed. And that's a whole separate situation. There was other things there that prevented Don Nelson from being successful. But, you know, even with the Yankees, I mentioned Girardi. Girardi's a totally different personality than Joe Torre. You know, with the Mets, Terry Collins – you definitely know. Well, you start with Willie and Jerry Manuel. Everyone loved Jerry Manuel because he was much more quotable and cool. And I mean, Jerry Manuel was a far worse manager than Willie Randolph was. I mean, that turned out to be a bad move, even though for the first few weeks it seemed to be working. And the question is, did the Mets turn things around in 2008 and get things going because Willie Randolph and Rick Peterson were fired? I don't think so. I think that the fact that Tony Bernazard was creating problems, and those went away when Jerry Manuel came back in, and I think there was a lot of dissension with backstabbing and both Manuel and Bernazard trying to get both Omar and Willie's jobs. I think that had a lot to do with it, because then the harmony and the discontent goes away. Well, you know, that's not the point. The point is, you don't want to just hire somebody because they're the exact opposite of what Terry Collins was. That's why you don't want to just hire Joe McEwing, because he's emotional. The fans, you know, I know they want emotion and they want to feel like a manager cares. I told you, there's the three things. If the guy, whether you visually see it or not, manages that clubhouse, you know, managing the media also falls into that, you know, maybe you don't always get the right quote or the right feel. That's the PR. That's the public persona. That's important. Less important, unless they're going to eat you up because of it. And that could happen. And then it's the bullpen. And I don't know, you did not get a lot of good feels from Ventura. You know, McEwing is relatively unknown. He falls into the Alex Cora era mantra. You don't know. I mean, everyone might like him for the wrong reason. So a lot of stuff there. And as the month goes on, like I said, I don't know if we're going to have podcasts weekly because you really want to do something newsworthy. But I'll try to get other out-of-towners. Maybe we'll find out a little bit about Chip Hale. Maybe there's a lot we can dive into here and learn a little bit from competitive bloggers or writers or things like that. As you heard coming back from the commercial, you heard Jay Bruce's game-tying home run for the Indians. And I think everybody now, a year later, when at this time last year, everybody couldn't wait to run Jay Bruce out of town for just any middle reliever. And I think I as well was on that. But I've learned a little bit about Jay Bruce watching him over the course of a season. He really won me over in spring training when he basically told the reporters, hey, we'll do respect. I don't care what you guys think. I don't care what the fans think. I know what I could do. You guys aren't going to swallow me up here in New York, despite you thinking that's what happened the prior year in 2016. Had a very nice season for the Mets. He's a run producer. I think he's a guy that's shown when given the opportunity. He hasn't been given many of those opportunities in his career. Can come up with a big hit. He has his flaws, both offensively and defensively. And he's certainly a guy that I think the Mets, should think about going back out and bringing back. Now, here's the thing. you do run the risk, and I said this when they traded off veterans, when you trade veterans for something, just because they're free agents, to get something in the organization, an asset, you run the risk that they go somewhere else, they fall in love, and they want to stay there, and it becomes that much harder to re-sign them. Bruce probably falls into that category. He wins a World Series with the Indians, and I don't know what the Indians' budget is or what they're looking to do. It's going to become that much harder to pull him away. Ohio guy, Cincinnati, he's probably going to say, why would I go back to New York? But listen, anything can happen. With that said, and I teased this right after the Margalis interview before we went to commercial, the guy that I continue to look at, if the Mets are only going to be able to sign one impact bat in free agency, you have Bruce, you have Moustakas, you have the third guy, and that's the guy I'm looking at, is Eric Hosmer. I don't know what Eric Hosmer is going to get. It's going to be $20-plus million. I understand he's a first baseman, and I understand from reading a little bit up about him that the defensive metrics, the advanced defensive metrics, don't paint this kind of picture about Hosmer as the gold glove or, I guess, the visual one does. All I know is this is a guy that wants to win, has been on a world's champion. I felt he was one of the leaders of the Royals. You saw what kind of heads-up player he is when he made that play in game 5 with the 2015 World Series. He has a pedigree. He has the mindset. I feel like that's a guy that would be a leader here that could make a difference. He plays a position where, yes, you have Dominic Smith, a young player, but Dominic Smith didn't show you much. Dominic Smith, and you heard Russ Langer, you heard Russ Langer allude to it. You had actually Russ Langer allude to the issues Pedro Lopez had, if you go back to that June interview. He may be a guy that's going to pop some home runs against bad to mediocre pitching or average pitching. He's going to struggle a little bit with the bat consistently. And I didn't see a hell of a lot in the field from him to make me get excited about his defense. I understand it's a small sample size and what have you, but if you're going to go into the season with both Rosario and Dominic Smith as your shortstop and first baseman, I don't know if you could consider yourself a contending team. I'm fine with Rosario because you have Cabrera coming back, but I would feel better if you have Reyes coming back on that or a veteran that could step in and play every day and not have a huge drop-off, not a guy that's a veteran that really can't be an everyday player, because if something happens, Rosario is just not ready. And the year after, sophomore slump that you saw with Conforto that they have to address, you need someone that could step in. And Hosmer, I think, would alleviate the clumsiness that bringing a Jay Bruce back creates. Conforto's going to be back. May not be back opening day. He's going to be back. I don't know if Conforto's a center fielder. He's done an adequate job defensively there. You have Cespedes. Do you prefer the defense of Lagares? You have Cespedes in left. You maybe have a lefty complement like Nimmo for Lagares in center. You have Conforto in right. You put Hosmer at first. You go out and you figure out if Cabrera is your second baseman or your third baseman because you don't know what's going to happen there. You have Rosario at short. And then maybe you go and you find a decent bat for a second. Maybe even use Wilmer Flores. If you bring in a Hosmer, you would like to have Flores' bat, but he cannot play defense. And he's more of a guy that you want to move around the field. Maybe you use Flores' bat to go out and see what you could get from an American League club because I really think Flores is more of a DH. So that's something for you guys to think about. Eric Hosmer is the one that I continue to gravitate towards. And there's going to be competition. You hear that the Red Sox are going to be in on him. Maybe the Yankees. I don't know what their thoughts are on Greg Bird. The Royals, because of who he is and who they know he is from a leadership and how much he's meant to the fabric of that team, maybe wanting to go in there and bring him back. And the Mets budget is something that's, not exactly going to be open-ended here, where they could go out and get whoever they want. They have to be right about the big money player they go after. And I know they're looking at some big name relievers. That's the rumor, at least, and that's going to cost them. But to me, Eric Hosmer, if you had a choice between Hosmer and Bruce, I think you go after Hosmer because I think it creates less of a clumsy situation with the team. And I'm really not into Jay Bruce at first base. I know that he could probably learn it, but I think the Mets need to improve their defense, and that's not happening with Jay Bruce. I think Eric Hosmer does that on both the offensive. You don't lose anything offensively. I think you get pretty much as good, if not better, because you have more of the average contact with Hosmer than you have with Jay Bruce. I'm looking at this from far away. I'm only watching Hosmer and reading about him and watching him in a small sample. So that's my final thought here on this Sunday, and I appreciate everybody joining in, and of course, you know, continue to, you know, check out the podcast and support this this podcast. I want to thank Jim Margalis of SouthsideSox.com. You can check him out at Jim Margalis on Twitter. Of course, I want to thank all of you guys for checking out and tuning in. I want to thank the good folks over at MetsMorizedOnline.com. Of course, you can check me out all the time at Mike Silva Media on Twitter, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. Let me know if I'm not on one. I'll try to get on one. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday, and I'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you'll get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matters more than ever. Place your money line, prop, or parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.